Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia.
What a boy.
On today's show, Grammy-winning musician Rhiannon Giddens. With the Carolina Chocolate Drops, she brought old-time string music to a new generation. Her musical exploration continues on her debut solo album, Tomorrow Is My Turn. She's a headliner at the National Folk Festival in Greensboro, and she's here today in conversation with David Ford. Then we'll stay in downtown Greensboro and head over to Scuppernong Books. Owner Brian Lampkin has organized an eclectic homage to Black Mountain College. The school was only open 24 years, but its cultural impact lives on. Bethany Chafin takes us on a tour of Scuppernong's festival later in the show. Then we'll head to the Piedmont Plein Air Paintout. Organizer Julie Delgadio invited 30 artists for some outdoor art making in High Point, including painter Harold Frantz. All coming up on Triad Arts Weekend after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Later on the show, we'll celebrate the legacy of Black Mountain College with Scuppernong Books owner Brian Lampkin and producer Bethany Chafin. Then we'll head to High Point for the Piedmont Plein Air Paintout. But first, we'll focus on Greensboro and one of the National Folk Festival's headliners, Rhiannon Giddens.
What a boy! Where are you hiding? I'm gonna bust this rock, boy. From here to Macon, all the way to the jail, boy, all the way to the jail. You jack of diamonds.
Rhiannon Giddens was raised in Greensboro and studied opera at the Oberlin Conservatory in Ohio. She then immersed herself in rural music traditions and formed the Grammy-winning old-time string band, the Carolina Chocolate Drops. Rhiannon recently released her first solo album, the T-Bone Burnett-produced Tomorrow Is My Turn. You can expect to hear plenty of songs from the album when she takes the stage three times during the National Folk Festival in Greensboro. She spoke with Triad Arts executive producer David Ford.
What I love most about North Carolina is all the different regions that we have represented. You know, we've got the mountains, we've got the Piedmont, we've got the coastal area, and every area has its own distinct, you know, music, culture, and I love that. And I love the where we sit in the north-south continuum. We're very decidedly a southern state, but have been one that's kind of been a sort of rebelling one, you know, from the rest of the South, you know, for a long time and in different ways. And that's kind of fun, too, because it kind of turns the idea of what is Southern on its head, you know. You know, the folks who lived in the mountains who were not for the Civil War, you know, who weren't for the, you know, for the Confederates. And the, you know, all that kind of thing really makes, I think, North Carolina very interesting. And also, from a musicologist's point of view, the fact that, I mean, I wish that there had been more music recorded from North Carolina from like a long time ago, but the fact that there was so much focus on like the Delta blues and all this kind of stuff, I kind of feel like it just left music to just sort of keep rolling on here, you know, on its own without kind of being bothered or things put on it, you know. So I feel like the renaissance that's happening with like the old time music and the folk music and, you know, all of this kind of stuff that's happening in North Carolina, I think is a result of that, you know, because there wasn't this effort to sort of put this idea of what it should be on it. It just was kind of left alone, you know, because there was a Carolina, it was South Carolina, you know, because they had all the money and we were kind of the backwoods, you know, backwater place for so many years. But it just allowed us to kind of, we just developed this sort of culture that is a different culture from, you know, the plantation states. And, you know, and I think that is, the result of that shows itself in the music.
You think New Orleans jazz, Mississippi blues, North Carolina, a crossroads with so many great musical traditions from here. Are we starting to embrace that culture more broadly in your perspective from your where you sit? Or what do you see happening in, along those lines?
Oh, I think so. I think there's a realization of what we have here, the kind of musical treasures that we have in North Carolina, the folks who've come from the state, you know, and I think that that's definitely happening. I mean, people are becoming aware. And then there's more sort of roots groups coming from North Carolina, and that makes people more aware, you know, because they were aware of them, and then they want to know what's the history of it, you know, where are these guys coming from? So I think it's a flowering right now of North Carolina culture and music and the realization of what it means to be North Carolinian and kind of a pride in that, you know?
One of the great voices along those lines is Rhiannon Giddens and, of course, the Carolina Chocolate Drops prior. And I want to get into what you're working on now, just vocally. You have just a great instrument. Your stage presence amazing, and really enjoying seeing performances online and have seen you live. What's going on with you and performance today? What are you working on?
Well, I've been a band member for a long time, and you know, been in a seated string band for a while, and I'm just sort of exploring what it means to front a band, you know, to be a soloist. That's not really, you know, you're only a soloist if nobody's on stage with you. You know, you're really a collaborator whenever there's anybody else on stage, and I really believe in that. And my band has its own personality. Of course, it's made up of the current lineup of the Carolina Chocolate Drops and a drummer and a bass player, but they have their own, you know, I'm not like, you play this. I'm like, what do you want to play? You know, it's all a collaboration, really. But I'm enjoying, you know, sort of being in the front and just kind of inhabiting that and just embracing that and going, this is what I'm doing right now. So let me do it the best that I can, you know, let me do it to the best of my ability. And it's been fun, you know, just kind of discovering who I am as a performer. In ways that I haven't, you know, really explored in the past.
The Lord loves a sinner.
In terms of today, now we're looking at, you've been interviewed so many times in Rolling Stone and New York Times and NPR recently, heard that great interview. Is it a tough balancing act that the now that you're getting this kind of national exposure, the humility aspect of what you do, the sincerity of conveying that, but also, you know, the confidence that you need to portray to put on these concerts?
Well, you know what makes it easy? Is a couple things. One is that I know my stuff. You know, I read constantly, I research, you know, and as far as I'm a performer and not a professor, you know, I know as much as I can about, you know, and, you know, I'm, not to say I'm always going to get it right, but I feel confident in that I know enough to say what I'm saying, you know, and I think that's really important. The other thing is that I know why I'm here, and it's not to talk about my past boyfriends, and it's not to sing songs about, you know, what I ate this morning. It's about, you know, this responsibility I feel to music of the past, where it fits in the American dialogue of what is American music, you know, how it came to be. There's so much work to be done to enlighten, you know, just to get everybody into that dialogue in the right way. You know, we're sort of taught this very thin kind of wrong idea of where American music comes from. It's a real narrow view, and it's not always right. And to expand that and to deepen it, it's actually way more interesting than what, you know, what we're kind of taught, the actual story. And I feel like my responsibility is to do my part to help shine a light on what actually happens in American music and to bring things out that, you know, were buried, you know. So when you have a responsibility, then it's not about you, you know. So, and that's the way I like it, because it shouldn't be about me, you know. There's enough of that in the music industry. There's enough of, look at me, you know, that's covered, and that's something people enjoy, and that's fine. They're welcome to do it. When I come into it, like, if I'm going to do this, it's got to be about something bigger than me. Otherwise, I can go back to my, you know, I can go back to working in an office and you know, be at home with my family. Like, it's a hard life, so I want to feel like I'm doing something that's meaningful and that hopefully will have some sort of stay after I'm gone, you know, so some my contribution to it.
I wonder if you're referring to some of the misconceptions surrounding the music. Is this, for better or for worse, this kind of need for industries to pigeonhole music and musicians in certain styles? I was talking with Tim Duffy last week, And he was lamenting the fact that we're talking about Guitar Gabriel and how the guy could play bluegrass, he could play blues, he could play all these different styles, but he's known primarily as this and this alone, and that detracts from it.
And that's the way those guys were, because like when being a musician was playing what people wanted you to play, you know, in a lot of ways too, you know, like these working musicians, like people forget that people made a living. They were living, they were exposed to the radio, they were hearing things, you know what I mean? Like nobody wants to play the same old stuff, and that went for these old timers too. And that idea of tradition, the only reason why we have this kind of screwed up idea of what tradition is and that it's the static thing is because of the recording industry. You know, it for what the first time in human history we've had an opportunity to freeze something that is a living, changing tradition. You know, I mean, nothing gets passed on. It's like a big, giant game of telephone. Nothing gets passed on in the exact condition that, you know, it was before. And so now that we have recordings, people go, oh, you have to do exactly. No, you don't. That's the way they felt like doing it that day. You know, like they could have done it totally different. The next day they could have done it because Alan Lomax was in the room. So it's like there's all that stuff. And then you have the record companies enforcing these genres, saying white people play hillbilly music and black people play blues because that's the easy way to sell these records, you know. And that has really taken over the story of American music. And that frustrates me, you know, because it's, like I said before, it's way more interesting than that. We're doing ourselves a disservice by allowing that to be the paradigm, by allowing that to be the story. Like you take Sister Rosetta Tharpe. She's like my personal crusade because, like, you know, I do one of her songs on the record. And she was a pioneer of rock and roll guitar playing. I mean, she was highly influential. Some people even say she created rock and roll guitar. Like when you look at her performances, they're amazing. She was bridging the gap between secular and religious music. She was bridging the gap between, you know, like electric. And I mean, she was an incredible artist. And in her day, she was really well known, but she's been written out of the American music. She's not even in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm like, how did this happen? You know, when somebody who was such a giant, you know, all of a sudden gets written out. I mean, I have my own opinions as to why that happened, you know, if she was a black woman. But anyway, it's like, it doesn't fit. She didn't fit neatly into our idea of what American music is. And that's what happens. If you don't fit into the box, you're out. And it's like, what a loss. You know, she was an incredible musician. You know, I'm so glad for YouTube so we can like look at her videos and go, wow, she was incredible. Up above my head, I hear music in the air. Up above my head, I hear music in the air. Up above my head, I hear music in the air. I really do believe there's a heaven somewhere. The other thing is, you know, as I've been really thinking about history and what happens in African American history, is that you go from emancipation to Harlem Renaissance. And there's like 70 years or 60 years in between where there was a lot of cultural stuff going on, a lot of contribution to American culture that doesn't get recognized. And so there's so many things to go after. It's like, and I feel like I have work for years and years and years to come, and I'm happy about it because it's like the music is so incredible, and I love finding these things out and then presenting them and going, look at that, you know, people going, wow, you know, I didn't know that. I mean, that's a thrill.
It seems like with that as a backdrop, that Tomorrow Is My Turn, your debut solo album, is a big step in that direction in terms of breaking down the clarifying things, we'll say, for listeners. The variety that I find in the album is just amazing, and the dedication and the way you pull off the songs is so wonderful.
The last kind words I hear my dad say, Lord, the last kind words I hear my dad say.
Last kind words. You're such a great storyteller, and this song is, it just shows it off for me. Could you talk about how that ability has developed over the years for you, and what's the feeling like when you're in the middle of a great, great story like that, and you're telling it?
I like to say it's you're conjuring or you're channeling. It's like when you get in the right space, it happens. You know, I think a lot of that. I'm really grateful for my classical training, for not just the technique to help preserve my voice, but also the idea of telling a story. Because, you know, in every opera, you are a character And you are conveying emotions and you're trying to help tell this overarching story. And so when I took that into folk music, and folk music is also about telling stories. So it's just like all the reinforcements to that, you know. So when it comes to something like Last Kind Word Blues, you know, I think about my grandmother, I conjure these images and I think about like what this narrator is trying to say. And I don't try to get into too much exactly what it is. You know, because it's hard to get into the body of a black woman from the 1930s. You're like, and I'm not that. You know, I am only myself translating and trying to find my way into the skin of the song. But it's a feeling and a, you know, you focus on the words. It's like, you know, T-Bone would always say, remember that you're telling a story. And like, even in opera, you're taught something. Si canta come si parla. You sing like you speak. You know, and even in, you know, when you're doing the high Italian operas, you're supposed to be singing like you speak, you know. So you take that and you put it into Last Kind Word Blues and it goes to each line. You know, what am I saying in this line? You know, there's the overall story, which you can't really tell. You have to tell, you know, what you were saying right there. You know, it's like there's a thing in theater. You can't play the punchline. You know, like if you're playing the joke, expecting the laugh on the punchline, you're not going to get it. If you play the joke and then the punchline comes, you get the laugh because they feel your earnestness and your authenticity because you're in that moment. And I think that's the same with a song. You have to be in the moment all the time.
The Mississippi River, you know it's deep and wide. I can stand right here. From the other side.
You mentioned T-Bone and T-Bone Burnett, producer for this record. Tell me about the arrangement and working with T-Bone, just the clarity of the instrumentals and paired with the vocals. It's beautiful.
I think it was a really great match. You know, he came and he said, you know, let's do a record. What do you want to do? And I had this idea and I sent him all these songs and he said, great. You know, and I think that given his like knowledge of American music and his deep, deep history of you know, his production and the people that he works with, you know, I think he was like it was the perfect matchup, you know, project to producer. I really do. I mean, he didn't know that's what he was going to get when he asked me to do it, but I think he saw it immediately that was going to be, you know, that's which is why he said, yeah, let's do it, you know. And just the sounds that he's able to get and, you know, the engineers that he works with, I mean, they're top notch. And so, you know, it's the kind of record that I probably, you know, I don't know if I get it again. You know, it's like, it's a luscious, it's sumptuous, you know, it was all recorded onto tape, you know, the transfer to vinyl is beautiful. And I mean, everything, the sound quality is so gorgeous. So, you know, having these songs benefit from that, you know, makes me feel really good. You know, it's like, it's not just a bunch of originals, which is great, you know, but like, I feel even better that it's these time-tested, like incredible, you know, pieces of art that get the treatment that, you know, that T-Bone does.
Those who may reach for the stars, others will end behind bars.
Speaking of the lush arrangements and then also harkening back to our original conversation about pigeonholing music, the shift of styles in your title cut, Tomorrow's My Turn, speaks to that so beautifully to me because it's not only just a wondrous string arrangement and really lush sounds. Well, you're singing both tunes, but and it's all your voice, but you capture both styles so wonderfully. Just for listeners, it was originally a theme to a 1962 film about French prisoners during World War II. How did you go about song selection for this album, and was it a daunting task at all?
No, because I had a list already. You know, it was like stuff that wasn't fitting in the Chocolate Drops. I was like, well, this is not really a Chocolate Drop song. This is, you know, and that's the list that I sent T-Bone, and it had kind of self-selected. I was already thinking about women in Americana music, and I'm reading autobiographies, and it kind of had just become a thing already. You know, so when we started adding songs, I stuck to that core, you know, idea, and so. It wasn't. It was what was hard was figuring what to leave off.
What a boy, where are you hiding? If you don't come right here, I'm gonna tear upon you. There ain't no hell. That's Hornady's
in this tune, Waterboy, so many just amazing vocal inflections, embellishments, melismas, whatever you'd want to call them, that sound so natural and beautiful and flowing. I was just curious how much of that you go into the recording knowing pretty much exactly which way it will turn, how much is done on the fly, depending on how you're feeling in that moment.
I'd say this kind of recording where I hadn't toured the songs, you know, it was really on the fly. So it's just like I went in there and, you know, what happened is what happened, you know. With other types of recordings, I've already road tested them and I've figured out, okay, oh, that's a great turn I just happened to do, I'll keep that. You know, like things evolve and they change and then they become kind of what I want to record, you know. But this record is the first time I've ever done where I just walk in, haven't sung the songs before. I mean, Waterboy had sung that one time in a performance, but haven't really workshopped them, haven't worked on them, go in and just... And there's a certain kind of magic in that. It's something that suits T-Bone really well. You get a crack group of musicians together, you know, so you don't have, there's no learning the song beforehand. They listen to the source recording. We go in, what key is it in? And, you know, we work on it for half an hour, it's done. I mean, it's there, the magic of discovery, then, you know, what the result is. And that's a magic that you can't match again until you've done it a whole bunch of times, you know? So it's like one or the other. You have to like have it solid and then the magic of just what's going to happen because we've done it so many times or what's going to happen because we've never done it before. You know, it's a really interesting process and one I'd never done. And I really like it a lot. I mean, I've listened to it now and I'm like, oh, I do that so much better. I do that so much better, you know? But as a record, I think, you know, it just gives it this kind of energy, you know, that's hard to get.
I never forget you telling me about a tune you recorded once where you gave it several go at. It was just an a cappella solo voice tune. You were just sitting on a porch and you belted it out and that was the take. That was the one you used. Did that ring a bell?
That was maybe Leaving Eden because we recorded some stuff on Buddy Miller's porch. And yeah, we had tried it and we had tried. I think it's even got crickets you can hear. You know what I mean? And it was just like, sometimes the time is right. And it's just like, and sometimes when you've done it so many times or you're just like, I'm never going to get this tune, that's when you get it. And that's where a producer comes in because they know how to push and they know, go, okay, well, why don't you just do it one more time and then we'll just leave it. And that's the one, you know what I mean? So all of that stuff, it's such a delicate process recording. I mean, you know, because you want to capture the emotional connection to it. When you've done it 10 times, it's, you know, so it's like, there's a fine line between going over it and hitting it because you've let go. You've gone off. I'm never going to get it, and that's the one you get.
You and I, just reading through your bio, share something in common. Your father was white. Your mom was a black woman. My father was black. My mom was a white woman. In Louisville, Kentucky is where I was born. And my grandfather, who was a black Trinidadian, couldn't go to that wedding. There was no way he could be there. It would have been a horrible scandal. With that as a backdrop, and you grew up in Greensboro, and they had to go to a different county to get their wedding certificate. Where do you see things today with the debate swirling around flags and race relations in general in our country or in our state? What, if anything, I mean, how do you assess the situation? So many things happening, so many conversations.
You know, it's tough because there's so many tragedies that have happened, you know, but this is where knowing history is important, you know, and this is where I feel like my mission is important as an artist to highlight things in an artistic way, because what art does is it's a shortcut between the head and the heart. You know, maybe somebody's not going to read that book about slave narratives, but if you write a song about that's a story, they feel that emotional connection immediately, you know, and then maybe who knows what they do from there. But I think that's what an artist's job is to do, you know? And so when you look at the history of it, I'm actually hopeful, you know, because, you know, sometimes it's the worst before it gets better. And I feel like that's where we're at right now. The difference that I'm feeling right now is not that black churches are getting shot up, because they've always been shot up. They've always been terrorized. It's not that black men are being shot by cops, because they've always been killed by cops. It's not that, you know, things are so bad in the inner cities, because that's been the situation. What's hopeful to me is that we now have the technology to capture when a cop goes to a swimming pool and you know, does these things. We have the technology to capture it and the technology to disseminate it. And we also have allies who are willing to start to speak up. You know, people from the dominant culture who are saying, you know what, this isn't right, you know? And I think that is the hopeful thing to me, is that it's not that it's happening, it's that people are now becoming aware that it's happening, you know, and that it has to change. And I can only be hopeful. I mean, because like otherwise it's just like you can't get up out of bed in the morning. So, you know, I do what I can do to help facilitate that. And, you know, as I think biracial people are really important in that because we grew up with both sides, you know, and so I think we naturally kind of can put ourselves in other people's shoes because you have to, you know, you have to navigate, especially growing up in the South, you have to navigate, you know, those rocky shoals. So I just think that, you know, we have to keep talking. We have to keep speaking up. We have to keep saying, you know, this isn't right. And the most important thing, I think, is connection, you know, between the different races, between the different cultures, between different socioeconomic statuses, and not pointing fingers and going, you know what, your ancestor, you know what, they didn't do that. You know, just like I wasn't, you know, raped and murdered, you know, 200 years ago. Like, I got a pretty good life. You know, I have privilege. You know, it's like where we all have to kind of recognize the system is screwed up. This is not about you. And it's not about me. It's about the system. And we have to fix the system. And I think when people don't feel like they're being attacked, you know, they'll be more willing to get into it. And when people realize, you know, this isn't my fault that I'm in this situation. You know, the system is messed up, and now I have to figure out how I can get myself out of it. It's getting together. It's fixing the system. You know, that's if the system is broken, it's never going to get better.
Well, thank you so much, Rhiannon Giddens, for raising awareness and for your new album. And I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
On my watch, on my chain, everything that was in my name.
Rhiannon Giddens. Her debut solo album is called Tomorrow Is My Turn. You can see her live this weekend during the National Folk Festival. It's a 3-day free event featuring over 300 artists and artisans in downtown Greensboro. She's performing on Saturday, September 12th at 1 p.m. and Sunday, September 13th at noon and 4:15 p.m. You'll find much more on Rhiannon Giddens and the National Folk Festival at WFDD.org and click on Try It Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll take a look at the enduring legacy of Black Mountain College when Try It Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Try It Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Later in the show, we paint in the great outdoors via the Piedmont Plein Air Paintout. But first, Bethany Chafin and a celebration of a curious college.
If you've heard the name Black Mountain College, but never quite knew the story behind it, or even if you're a Black Mountain College expert, Scuppernong's Festival next week is for you. The experimental interdisciplinary art school opened in 1933 in Black Mountain, North Carolina, just outside Asheville. It stayed open for only 24 years, but during that time it attracted America's leading artists, composers, and poets. Scuppernong Books owner Brian Lampkin joined me to discuss this unique community, its history, and its legacy.
So Black Mountain College started in 1933, and it was short-lived, really. It only lasted until 1956. But the extraordinary amount of influence those 23 years had on American arts, it's just remarkable. And the fact that it existed in little Black Mountain, North Carolina, you know, how did it land here, and why did it thrive there? Because no matter how short it was this thriving arts world. People often think of a failure if something doesn't last forever. Well, I don't think that's true at all. You know, I think often a short life can be, you know, richer and deeper, and that's what Black Mountain College offered, this blast that changed so much about American arts, particularly poetry, I would argue.
Mm-hmm. And why was it established? I understand it was established by a few professors who left Rollins College.
Yeah, John Edgar Rice. But also a big influence from Germany, actually, of artists and intellectuals fleeing, you know, the encroaching Nazi regime, you know, some of the Bauhaus movement. So it had this great early intellectual rigor, which never waned, along with really progressive, unique ideas about what education might be.
So if someone enrolled there, do you have any idea what kind of classes they would take or what kind of an experimental environment were they entering into?
Yeah, in it would change over the course of various periods. But early on, it was rigorous. It was more design-oriented early on, even engineering. But the idea was always an alternative sense of what education was, that it certainly was not about, you know, whether you're going to get a $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 job or whatever. You know, it was about this growth as an individual. It was about this belief in your art and your commitment to it. And it was a hands-on environment. And that never changed. The absolute insistence that you're there, you're doing your work. You know, the rigorous education piece was there too, but you had to have this component of the actual making of whatever it was you were making, whether it was pottery or painting or poetry.
Mm-hmm. Great. So why, 50 plus years later, are you all celebrating this in a festival?
Yeah, why does it latch on to people? It latches, like, for me, Black Mountain College, when I first came across it, probably in the early 80s, you know, it just says, wow, this place actually existed. And as you delve into it, I read all these poets who just like resonated with me, and like, how could they all have been in one place at one time? And what an amazing world that must have been. And you sort of, at least I did, I sort of idealize it, right? I sort of picture this as a place that maybe had like the Shangri-La almost that existed once. And I know the reality is not that. You know, I know there's all sorts of trouble and problems and disagreements, but there was also the work that came out of that place just kind of blew my mind. And that lasts for me and for many, many others. One of the events we're doing is Professor Alex Albright from East Carolina University is coming to talk about why Black Mountain College ought to matter but doesn't, you know, which is his sense of how did this amazing thing happen and why don't we care more? So there's that level too. We're on the sort of public consciousness, Black Mountain College barely exists. But for certain individuals, it matters more than almost anything. Right?
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I was in Asheville last fall, and you know the legacy and the relics, and I think there's actually a brick and mortar kind of space devoted to the history of it.
Yeah.
So there, it's definitely palpable. But go ahead.
Yeah, Bethany, and palpable. I think like the resonance you feel from the fact that this place existed in the Black Mountain Asheville area carries on in ways you can't predict. Like, I think Asheville exists in all its Ashevilleness to some extent because Black Mountain College was nearby, you know? This history lives through the time, you know, and it sort of permeates the Asheville culture. It gives the Asheville culture this real depth of history. And I still see a play out there. You know, the museum is there, the Black Mountain College Museum is there, mm-hmm. and they do yearly, I think they call them rehappenings. Where they'll bring in people from all over the country to talk about Black Mountain College. But I don't know, you just get the vibe. It's still alive there.
Yeah. We use the phrase rehappening, and you're going to have a happening as part of this festival as well. Yeah. Explain what a happening is.
I mean, the argument is that the first one ever happened at Black Mountain College. And a happening is where all varieties of art are going on all at the same time in the same space. So at Black Mountain, you might have had Buckminster Fuller dancing, whatever that might have been like, along with a poetry reading going on and various music going on and pottery being done and painting being done all in the same place at the same time, in the spirit of joy, in the spirit of adventure, in the spirit of, you know, art is really fun as well. You know, despite all the work that goes on elsewhere, let's have this one moment where it explodes in this great joyous event.
What are some of the other events that you're looking forward to as part of this festival?
You know, I guess the thing I'm most happy about is how excited the people I called to invite were. And they say, wow, you're doing that? I'm in, you know? You know, from Joseph Bethanty, who is the previous North Carolina Poet Laureate. So he'll be here at Scuppernong on what day? On Monday the 21st. And he'll be talking about the writer Fielding Dawson, who is a Black Mountain writer, fiction writer. And they were good friends. And Joseph and Fielding did a lot of prison work together, and we'll be talking, I know, a lot about that when he's here. So that'll be great. The thing maybe that's most notable is Peter Coyote is coming to the store on the 22nd. So he'll be there at 6 o'clock to talk about his new memoir, The Rain Man's Third Cure. And if you don't know Peter Coyote, and I'm sort of surprised, like I'm so excited, Peter Coyote is coming, right? But a lot of people really don't know who he is, I realize. But you all know him. You know, he was in E.T. you know, he was Keys in E.T., the NASA mm-hmm. guy carrying all the keys around. But he's been in, you know, dozens and dozens of movies, and he narrates just about everything Ken Burns has ever done. He narrates a bunch of National Geographic stuff. But Peter Coyote is a weird dude. He's a heavy dude. he started like this anarchist movement in San Francisco called the Diggers. They created a really caring sense of your community and what an anarchist movement might really be. And he also started the San Francisco Mime Troupe. And he's a Zen priest at this point and a lover of poetry. So he'll be here at 6 o'clock on the 22nd of September.
Wow.
Yeah.
He does everything.
He does everything, yeah. And that's kind of the Black Mountain spirit, though, right? That it is possible to let your curiosity blossom in a million different directions. And you have all these interesting people in one place at one time, you know, you can taste all of it, right? And mm-hmm. you can let your mind explore all of it. You know, in the summer sessions at Black Mountain, people as extreme as, you know, Albert Einstein was there for one summer session, and Robert Rauschenberg,
really?
and all sorts of interesting people were there. And you're tapping into all these interesting minds and adapting it for your own work, whatever that might be.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great model.
I think it is. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you whether you think that, you know, this current fascination with an investment in some new maker spaces in the area, is that kind of along the lines of the spirit of what was going on there?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, whether it's a direct influence on those people, I can't say. But definitely that's the same spirit, you know, mm-hmm. that same sense of a bunch of people sharing a space and using the energy of, you know, the people around you to help your own creation. And that model, you know, it played out in MIT, I think it was, this famous building at MIT, that they had a bunch of professors at MIT that they didn't know what to do with, so they threw them in this building out back. And so it ended up being like Noam Chomsky and various physicists, and they all ended up in this building that had shared space. Thus, they shared ideas, they shared conversations, they shared coffee. And that's what it takes. You know, you don't want the isolated person working in their own world. Mm-hmm. You know, you want the active mind out in the world engaging with other active minds. And that's a makerspace idea. That's a Black Mountain idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking about such reverence we have for these ideas and how important they were. Why did the college close? What happened?
Money. You know, the classic story. Because the realities are sometimes people want a job. You know, people don't necessarily see the utility of going to this place in the, you know, the wilds of the North Carolina mountains to get either not a degree or not much of a degree that's going to be worth anything to you. So it was hard to get students. So by the late 50s, there was I can't remember the story exactly, but there was a granting institution coming to visit the campus. And they only had like a handful of students at that time. So the students would go to one class, run to their dorms and change and become a different student and go to the next class, just so the granters would seem to the granters like there were a bunch of students around. Look at it. You know, that's how desperate times got towards the end there. You know, the real story is difficult. You know, I don't think there was a lot of malfeasance or anything like that, but you know, when times get hard, it's, you know, it's hard to pay people. It's hard to pay professors. When you stop paying people, they stop coming. And the whole sad demise follows. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Brian, give me an idea of the makeup, the demographic of the students and the professors and who was living in this community.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the more interesting aspects of it is that in this tiny town in North Carolina, there were, you know, in 1940s and 50s, there were Black people and white people living together, like, which was not a popular idea in Black Mountain, the town itself. I think there was always this, if not more than tension, like just even disagreement to the point of threats, that the town was really tired of those kind of freakish folks living up there in the mountain. And then when you add this whole sense of a progressive racial environment that believed that people of Black and white could live together, it was just far too threatening for many of the locals. But, you know, with that said, there was also, it was not utopia. And I know I sound a little like rosy about it all, but there were serious issues around how women were treated. You know, there were certainly predatory professors and many, many writers. The great writer Francine Duplessis Gray talks about the very difficult time she had as a woman at Black Mountain College. in many ways, women artists were not respected by some of the professors there. On the other hand, there were some great women artists who blossomed at Black Mountain, too. You know, just to say, nothing is simple. Everything is complicated. But the spirit of Black Mountain was exemplified by maybe Jacob Lawrence, the great African-American painter, who has a show up at MoMA right now. And the fact that he could find a place at Black Mountain and become the painter he was because of his experience at Black Mountain speaks volumes.
So one of the names I'm seeing fairly often or several times on the schedule is David Landry. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about him.
World's best human. David is, I don't know, my dearest friend, a professor of mine when I was young. But he was a student of Charles Olson's. And Charles Olson was the giant poetic figure of Black Mountain College in the later years. He was the rector of the place. And just a massive person, like he was, I think he was 6'7", you know, near 300 pounds, and a huge intellectual force. And so David had the amazing experience of being his student in Buffalo in the 1960s. So he's going to come down and talk about his experiences with Charles Olson. But besides that, David is just a really remarkable poet in his own right and just, you know, a lovely human being. You'll just enjoy being in his company. He's going to talk about Melville on the 23rd. Charles Olson was a huge Melville scholar and wrote a book called Call Me Ishmael that David will talk about. And on the 22nd, there'll be a panel of poets, Jeff Davis from Asheville, who's a Black Mountain freak and lover of Robert Creeley, another great poet out of Black Mountain College. So David and Jeff and Charmaine Cadu Ward will talk about the poets of Black Mountain College, and maybe Peter Coyote will join that panel because I know he has a great love for all these poets as well.
Scuppernong Books owner Brian Lampkin. The Black Mountain College Festival is happening September 16th through the 25th at Scuppernong Books. It's 10 days of events celebrating the legacy and history of North Carolina's Black Mountain College. For a full schedule and links to more information, visit our website at wfdd.org. And once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Triad Arts Associate Producer Bethany Chafin. We have one more break, but stick around for an inside look at outside painting when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. The Piedmont Plein Air Paintout is taking place next weekend in High Point. Plein air, when translated from French, means in the open air. A fitting title, as this event features 30 nationally known artists painting outdoor scenes in 5 locations around High Point. It begins next Thursday, September 17th, with a quick paint event, and ends on Sunday, September 20th. That's when the public is invited to come see the artwork produced over the 4 days. Festival organizer Julie Delgadio and participating artist Harold France spoke with David Ford before last year's paint out.
Question. How do you do that, Harold? I mean, how do you create a landscape such that it looks like you could be in that landscape? In terms of perspective, for example, what kind of considerations go on?
Of course, the canvas is a two-dimensional painting surface, and what we're trying to do as artists is to create the illusion that it has a third dimension, that in fact that there is distance and you can actually walk into the painting. And you do that in a variety of ways. One way is simply using linear perspective. It's like standing in the middle of a railroad track and you see the rails converge. Another way is called aerial perspective, and that's as objects recede into the distance, certain colors do not project as well through space because of the impurities or just the type of color. They lose their vibrancy, they become blue, they become more muted. So a painter artificially incorporates those colors into his painting to create, again, the illusion of depth. And then, of course, other techniques are simply to overlap shapes and reduce the size of shapes so that if you paint a tree 6 inches tall and paint another tree 2 inches tall to the right of it or beyond it, then you would create the illusion that there was space and the small tree was farther away. So there are a variety of techniques that can be used and that artists typically use to create the illusion of depth and perspective and recession.
Excellent. I actually can picture all these things. That's wonderful.
I think he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, you've been doing it for a while. You know, more than 30 nationally known artists are going to be participating in this painting High Point in the surrounding Piedmont landscape. Where do the artists come from, and who all can participate?
We ran an ad in a national magazine, Plein Air magazine, back in March. It was a call to artists. It's a juried show, so we had Scott Rayner, who's the head of the art department at High Point University, was our selection judge. So it was his job to determine out of those applicants who could come participate in this event.
Describe the event in terms of the lay of the land in several different locations. Okay. How did you arrive at the locations for starters, and was that a tough choice within High Point?
We really thought about what High Point had to offer, and within each of those areas, what made it unique. So, for instance, as an example, one of the locations is City Lake Park. And within that one location, you have some older buildings. You have landscape opportunities with water and trees and wooded areas. You have a train and you have a merry-go-round. So within that one location, an artist would have a lot of choices there. So another criteria was that for an artist or for someone coming from Maine or from Florida who've never been to High Point, it gives them an easy access. So all of the locations are accessible off of one road.
Well, that's nice.
Except for downtown High Point, of course, as an option.
Harold, have you already picked out your location, or are you still mulling that one over?
I'm still mulling that one over. I live in Lexington, so I'm more of a local person. I'm somewhat familiar with High Point, but I haven't actually visited the sites that she mentioned with an eye for what I might paint. Just visiting an area is different for an artist than visiting an area with an eye for what might make a suitable painting.
Tell me about that transformation, the feeling one gets when you immerse yourself in a location as an artist and you're trying to replicate what you see through your own eyes and sensibilities. What goes on there between the ears?
Well, I think most artists paint a subject because they're attracted to it in some way. The things that attract me most are typically the colors and the value patterns.
Could you break that down for me? I've heard that term used often. I'm still not quite familiar with value patterns and what that means.
Value is simply how light or dark a color is. Black is a very dark color, obviously, and white would be the lightest color that you could use. So having light colors surrounded by darker colors, to me, makes a greater visual impact. That's typically why I paint early morning or late afternoon than painting at noon when the sun is directly overhead and subjects and surrounding elements tend to all be mid-tones.
More contrast.
That's exactly right. And for me, that helps highlight the center of interest or the main subject within the painting. So when I visit an area, I kind of go with that in mind. And usually, because I've been painting outside for a while, because of my interest in color and values, I always use the phrase, something will jump up and say, paint me, paint me. And so I have that emotional reaction. And once I have that emotional reaction, then I begin to think about how I can translate that reaction from that subject to the canvas. So it's not just, well, let's say I like to paint boats, but every boat I saw might not make a good painting. So you not only look at objects, but you begin to look at them in ways that you could present them on canvas to make the kind of painting that fits your particular style. So when I go to an area, I'm looking for things that kind of have that emotional impact, that paint me quality. And as I look at that, then I begin to envision where I could place that on the canvas, what other accompanying elements within the area could be used, and they don't have to be right beside the subjects. An artist takes, they call it artistic license, and we can move things around to create, we call a balanced design. And so that's what I look for. I look for something that creates the visual impact. It may have the colors that I like. It certainly has a strong value pattern, value contrast. It could also have interesting shapes. It may be the lines, like an old gnarled tree. But one or perhaps all of those make that impression on me. And then with practice, you can begin to kind of quickly envision how you might reproduce that vision or that impact on canvas. And so that's the way I approach areas that I want to paint. And I typically try to approach those between 7 and 10 in the morning, or perhaps between 4 and 7 in the afternoon. The sun is low enough that I get those strong shadows and I get that strong, very obvious visual impact.
You're there for hours and hours looking at that gnarled tree. Are you looking at that inner dialogue as you're painting this object? What goes on there? What kind of conversations go on, if any, during that process?
Well, they definitely do, I think, for me and for many artists, because for me, painting is a very thinking process. It requires thought at every step of the way, and I envision myself as actually building a painting based on certain principles that I use. And so I'm constantly thinking, I'm constantly analyzing, I'm constantly observing and solving problems. I'm trying to present the colors, the shapes, the values, the lines in a way that are consistent with the reaction that I had. And so I'm not just there painting a gray tree. By experience, the gray tree may have a dozen different colors because of the moss, the position of the sun, the type of bark. And so I'm trying to translate those onto the canvas, not in a very detailed way, but in a way that I think captures the expression of the tree, the personality and the character of the tree. And so I see things as having character and personality, and I want to recreate that on canvas, and that requires a lot of thought. To me, I don't spend more than, in an outdoor small painting, 2 to 3 hours. I don't paint all day. An 8x10 I can paint in an hour, hour and a half.
Completed.
Without a lot of detail, but outdoor paintings don't have a lot of detail. So I can go out and paint an 8x10 painting in an hour and a half, 2 hours max, and I'm ready to frame it and hang it up.
Julie Delgadio and artist Harold Frantz. The Piedmont Plein Air Paintout is September 17th through 20th in High Point. The public is invited to see the artwork produced on Sunday, September 20th at the J.H. Adams Inn. There's going to be live music and food trucks on site, and net proceeds from artwork sales will benefit the YWCA of High Point. For more on the Piedmont Plein Air Paintout, visit WFDD.org and click on Try It Arts Weekend. Triad Arts Weekend's executive producer is David Ford. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our contributing editor is Kike Rodriguez-Pastor. You'll find podcasts, archived episodes, and links to our guests, events, videos, and more on our website, WFDD.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can follow us on Twitter as well. Our handle is Triad Arts Speak. And be sure to like WFDD on Facebook. Triad Arts Weekend is a production of 88.5 WFDD, public radio for the Piedmont. I'm Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.